Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Vox Pop. I got to tell you, it is always my pleasure when Dr. Paul Lemanski is with us. He is as close to the house doctor as anything you're going to find around here. Dr. Lemanski joins us today. He'll respond to your questions. We've already got three people on the phone. He comes to us from his new Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine. It's going to be quite something, the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine. Dr. Lemanski is a board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventative Medicine, Dr. Lemanski was clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's currently assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and a fellow of the American College of Physicians. Paul Lemanski, thank you so much for being here with us. Tell us about your new center.
Well, first, I'm happy to be back. It's an interesting position that I've been offered because it focuses on community medicine and population health. And, of course, population health in the years to come is going to be where we're at in medicine. So to this point in time, physicians have been reimbursed on the basis of what they do for an individual patient. In the future, they're going to be reimbursed for how they manage a population of patients. And this becomes important because as the amount that the government is willing to pay goes down, the better that we manage a population of patients in terms of both outcome and the cost of care is going to be critical.
So when you say a population, doesn't that discourage or isn't that a disincentive to take people who are at risk?
Well, no, because they're included in the population. So you have a population that you manage, and those that are at high risk for various medical problems are going to be more difficult to manage, require more resources, but they're going to be offset, hopefully, and this is, again, what makes it interesting, they're going to be offset by how well we manage people who are less ill and therefore perhaps more able to be managed with lifestyle change, good habits, Alan, lowering cholesterol, you know, a more natural way, eating more healthfully rather than simply taking medication, and, you know, losing weight as opposed to waiting around until we become diabetic. I think, you know, all of these approaches, these so-called non-medical approaches or medicinal approaches to the management of disease become critical when the costs of care become critical as they are now.
So, you know, one of the things that you've done for us in the past is talk to us about nutrition, talk to us about the medication that's there. Is there anything new that's coming around that we ought to know about, that we all ought to know about in terms of a magic pill of any kind?
No magic. That's what's new. The more we learn, the more we realize there is no magic. And, you know, one needs to do the due diligence in order to remain healthy. It's not going to be a pill you take. It's going to be how much you walk. It's not going to be, you know, medication-based, but how you live, the types of foods you eat. You know, these are the things that are going to drive health in the future. And we don't have to, you know, it's not to say that we can't or shouldn't take medication, but we should only take medication when it's necessary. It does not, however, get us out from, eating in a healthful way, practicing proper habits, not smoking. Sure. Those things really can't be reversed. Those issues, those risks can't be reversed simply by swallowing a pill.
What about red meat?
Well, you know, I think red meat, as I've said for a number of years in this room, there's nothing wrong with red meat. You know, there's nothing wrong with it, but the frequency with which it's consumed is important. So the more red meat you consume, the more health problems you're generally going to have.
So is there any disincentive for red meat, you know, for not eating red meat?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the
should you have no red meat?
Well, you know, I would say that if you you want to go to an extreme like sometimes you like to do.
Yes, I do.
You know, I think, you know, there's nothing unhealthful about eating a predominantly plant-based diet. That doesn't mean you have to be a vegan, you know, but for some people it becomes easier to, you know, practice veganism rather than to eat a small amount of meat.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, you know, we are omnivorous creatures, and the consumption of some animal protein is probably in our own best interest from a health perspective. That said, there are very few vegans that are going to be, you know, have chronic ongoing medical problems if they have practiced it for many years, and unless they have, you know, severe genetic predisposition to disease. It's you know, a predominantly plant-based diet can go a long way towards keeping us healthy. It's not an absolute guarantee, but it goes a long way.
Well, I can tell you is I was eating at the deli in Great Barrington the other day. I snuck in there with Roselle, and I ordered their best thing, which is a pastrami sandwich, which is fantastic. I just want to finish this one little thing. I had this pastrami sandwich. A lady jumps out of a chair behind me and said, "Aha, I caught you."
Well, you should always wear, you know, disguise when you...
A Groucho.
There you go.
Masking.
But, you know, a pastrami sandwich, you know, a couple of times a week is not a good idea. Once in a while is perfectly fine.
Sure. Let's go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Okay. Carolyn in Red Hook, you're on the air.
Hi,
go
Dr.
ahead.
Chartok. Hi, okay. Dr. Lemansky. You're also a cardiologist, right?
No, I'm an internist. I have an
internist.
Interest
okay.
in cardiovascular All right. prevention.
All right. I have a friend who has cholesterol problems, and we started using red yeast rice, a standardized extract, and the doctor wasn't comfortable with it, even though it was standardized, and so it did make a difference in his numbers. We started a small amount while he was still on his provostatin, and then we took him off that and put him on lecithin because he wasn't comfortable with the red yeast rice. And it seems to have made a big difference, although he's also made dietary changes. He's eating a lot less cheese and almost no red meat at all. Do you have any background, or have you done any reading about commissionee studies in Europe or the efficacy, regardless of commissionee, in terms of use of these items to help with cholesterol?
Well, I can tell you that neither red yeast rice or lecithin has any real outcome data to go along with
it. In this country.
In any country. I mean, I'm going to say...
That's not true.
Whoa, Carolyn. I'm up to
well,
the end.
You know,
I
mean, there's
you.
There's data, and then there's data, okay?
I
hear all the time on television, for example, you know, clinically proven, and when I call them up and I ask, well, clinically proven mean, they cite me a study with 6 patients in it and no control. So, you know, if you're gonna go ahead and say you have data, fine.
That's not good data.
Bring it forward. Let's see it.
Okay.
You know, I will tell you that large clinical trials of these substances have not been conducted.
Okay.
And large clinical trials of other medications have been conducted, and depending upon your level of risk. So, if you have cardiovascular disease, I would go with what has been proven in large clinical trials, unless you couldn't tolerate it. I would not opt for some unproven, although possibly true, and possibly effective approach when proven approaches are available. That said, you know, if you only have high cholesterol and you have no evidence of established atherosclerosis, then it makes perfect sense to try some, you know, especially if you don't want to use some of the medications that's out there, it makes sense that you try it and see how it affects your cholesterol profile.
Have you been aware of any studies done that are connecting some degree of dementia with statins?
Well, you know, I mean, any drug that's out there is going to be have reports of an association. Does not necessarily mean that is
causative.
A causal relationship.
Yep. Okay.
And so, and I have to understand there have been 100,000 patients randomized to clinical trials with statins, and there really is no convincing evidence that it causes dementia of any sort. In fact, sometimes in individuals who have what is called multi-infarct dementia, where they have multiple small infarcts in their brain resulting in enough loss of enough brain tissue that they become demented. But in those individuals, it actually can, there's some evidence that it can decrease that. Now, with regard to Alzheimer's, I can't say. And with regard to other types of dementia, I've heard many reports, but, you know, I think, again, one has to assess risk and benefit. If you have established atherosclerosis, you've had a heart attack, you have had a bypass operation, you've had a stent, or you've had a stroke, it is not a good idea to
rely on natural
methods. By that time, it's a bit too late, you know, to rely on a, to rely on a purely natural approach because you already have manifest disease.
Well, Paul and Carolyn, I thank you so much for this animated conversation, but we are out of time on this thing. And thank you, Carolyn, for calling.
Thank
you're
you.
Very welcome. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. We'll be back with Jim and Marie and Howard and everybody else who's calling. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, take it away, Professor.
Support comes from Nathan Latour Hospital, welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York. Accepting new patients, NLH.org. Adirondack Council, celebrating their 40th anniversary, educating citizens in the issues and decisions that shape the future of the Adirondack Park, AdirondackCouncil.org. And from the Urological Institute, offering urologic oncology with evidence-based comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer and Uronav MRI-guided precision diagnostics, urologyoncology.com.
Well, we got five phones ringing right now. So we'll go to our friend Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Would you speak a little bit about vasculitis?
Well, what do you want to know about it? I mean, I'm not an expert in vasculitis. What is the concern
or
question?
The clots and treatments.
Well, you know, vasculitis for the listeners is an inflammation of a vessel, okay? And so there are many different types of vasculitis because there are many different types of vessels that can become inflamed. It depends on which vasculitis you're talking about and what disease process is causing it. You know, individuals can, for example, have something called temporal arteritis, where the arteries leading into the temporal portion of the scalp and into the brain can be affected by vasculitis, and you get an inflammation of the vessel and swelling of the vessel, and so it can stop actually transmitting blood. And if you stop transmitting blood, then you can, you know, stop or have a problem with, for example, in temporal arteritis, you can lose your vision. And it becomes a very important diagnosis to make so that you can understand how best to manage it. You know, vasculitis and vasculitides in other vessels would correspondingly cause similar types of problems. Because of lack of blood flow in the part of the body to which, became involved. So it depends on what vessels you're talking about and what disease processes were causing the vasculitis.
Jim from Matamoros, as always, thanks for calling and asking a very good question. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Marie in Liberty, New York. Okay, great to hear from Liberty. Go ahead, Marie.
Yes, Ellen. I'm born the same year as you, 1941,
yep.
A few months older, and I'm 74, just turned 74 in April. And my concern, doctor, is about the LDL cholesterol. I had blood drawn on February 6th of this year, and I have the paper in front of me from Crystal Run Healthcare. It was, my LDL cholesterol was 177. Normal, it said in the letter, is less than 130. You know, they were saying your LDL is elevated. And then, of course, my good your HDL cholesterol was 72. Normal is greater than 45.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they were saying in the letter that I could with diet, change of diet and exercise, perhaps reduce this. So on May 26th, the first blood drawn was February 6th. So on May 26th recently, blood was drawn again to see if I managed to lower my LDL. I even cut out cream cheese, which I like. And I do walk quite a bit in the Village of Liberty. So I haven't received the formal letter yet from Dr. Selbo, but he said that my LDL actually increased about 2 points to 179. Here I am trying to reduce it, you know.
Right.
And then in my good cholesterol went from 72 to 74, which, again, it's already high enough. And so my question to you, I'm taking this natural product. I refuse to take a statin drug because I happen to know my liver is not that strong. And I've never been an alcoholic. That's not the problem. And so I'm taking Omega Q Plus 100 resveratrol in it. And it's I've only been on this about a month and a half.
Okay, but Marie, we're really sort of up against it. We got five people behind you. So I think as they say in the British Parliament, I refer them to question one, which was already answered.
Right.
So you've talked a little bit, Paul, about other outside substances.
Right. I think the first question would be determine, whether you needed to lower your LDL or not. If you look at the new guidelines, they recommend that individuals with LDLs over 190 be on a statin automatically. Other than that, it depends on what your history is. So, if, for example, if you had a heart attack or a stent or a bypass or a stroke, if you had any manifest atherosclerosis, then those individuals are recommended to go on a statin, which basically the attempt is going to be to get the LDL down, not under 130, but probably under 100. Now, if you don't have one of those conditions, then you can try lowering it by lowering as you've done, but perhaps not in as, direct and focused way. You can try to lower your LDL by decreasing the amount of saturated fat that you eat. So you would decrease the daily saturated fat to no more than 10 grams a day. If you were able to do that successfully for 3 or 4 months and got your repeat LDL, if you were not able to get it down with a dietary approach such as that, then the next approach would be to use a non-statin medication to do so. And bile acid sequestrants are one example of a non-statin medication.
What is Zetia?
Zetia is a cholesterol transfer protein inhibitor. So when the cholesterol that ends up in your bloodstream is from one of two sources. It's either from dietary cholesterol or it's from saturated fat. You eat dietary cholesterol, you absorb a certain amount of it, it ends up in your liver, and your liver can make saturated fat. LDL cholesterol from it. Same thing is true of saturated fat; it ends up in your liver, and your liver repackages it as LDL cholesterol.
And we should all remember the L stands for lousy.
Lousy damn lipid, right? So, the idea would be to use one of these other medications. Alan mentioned Zetia. Zetia would decrease your dietary cholesterol absorption and thereby lower your total LDL. A bile acid sequestrant works by a somewhat different mechanism to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Because this is 1.5 grams of saturated fat in this Smart Balance spread I've been using.
Okay, but wait. Just let's ask Paul a question here. Let's say you're on a regular American diet, and
it's not good.
No, right. And I'm going to give you things that you should or shouldn't have. Ready? Cream cheese.
Oh my goodness!
Don't have any butter.
That's right.
No.
Butter, no.
No.
Okay.
I know that.
Now, let's be clear on this.
Yes.
So those are the things we would exclude, knowing that they have a fair amount of saturated fat into it. If we then were able to control the numbers in a reasonable fashion, then we could start to introduce some of those back at a decreased frequency.
Unless you're an or nothing person.
That's
like
right.
I am.
That's right. In which case, you'd have to just give it up.
You give it up altogether, as I have done many times. Marie, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Steve in Woodstock. Steve, you're on.
Hey there.
Oh.
So I have a question. I was just recently diagnosed with CLL. I'm on the young side, 46, and I'm just interested to see if the doctor has any insight into the nutrition associated with a guy living with that.
Other than to, in a general sense, say to eat a healthful diet and a healthy diet. I don't. There is no data that I'm aware of to affect CLL, which is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, with diet specifically. There are treatments for it now. Okay, so in the past, mean life expectancy would be 10 or 12 or 15 years after diagnosis, and now, you know, there's a fairly effective treatment for it, so I don't think you have to be concerned in that regard, hopefully. You should be followed by a hematologist, nevertheless. So before you would decide on a that you did not require any treatment, you'd have to be seen by a hematologist, and they would have to assess your white blood cell count and the other circumstances of the disease, and then I assume that's how the diagnosis was made. And then if they felt that you didn't have to take any treatment, then I would just try to, you know, consume a healthy diet, which would be healthy in a number of different respects. So what we recommend generally, again, is a plant-based, predominantly plant-based diet would be the healthiest diet that we know for humans. Mediterranean diet being a type of a plant-based diet.
Live forever.
Well, as long live as healthfully and as in good health for the longest period of time. No, the human life is limited, Alan.
Okay, I was just kidding. Okay, thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Hello, Doctor. How are you doing?
Good.
I have actually two questions. One is, do you know a lot about stem cell therapy for particular physical ailments? How much do you know about it? And
no, I don't.
Do you have a specific question, Howard?
I'm talking about the question is, well, that was the question. Do you know much about?
Well, no, that's not a good question, to tell you the truth. A good question would be.
It's a pretty broad question.
Yeah, too broad. Go ahead.
For arthritic pain.
Well, my answer would be no. Okay, first of all, you need a diagnosis. Arthritic pain is not really a diagnosis. We'd have to know what kind of arthritis that you were talking about. There are places in the country that are doing research on the use of stem cells in the treatment of various types of joint disorders. I know Hospital for Special Surgery down in the city is at the leading edge of that. And they've done some very interesting work on repopulating the joint cartilage with basically stem cells, which would turn into cartilage cells. But, you know, that's really outside of my area completely, number one. Number two, it really is an area of ongoing research. So, you know, whether it's going to turn out to be the type of thing that will be effective for the majority of the population suffering from any specific arthritis, I can't say. But that would, you know, what you're talking about more is with respect to structural abnormalities in joints rather than inflammatory arthritis, you know, that can occur. Right. That rheumatologists are probably more appropriate to manage.
Yeah, that's where I'm going with it, yeah.
Howard, thank you. Thank you for your call. Okay, let's go to James in Saratoga. James in Saratoga, you're on.
Thank you very much, doctors. I have a question for Dr. Lemansky. About 2 weeks ago, I'm driving my car, and all of a sudden, I go to take a breath, and I have no lung function whatsoever. And that lasted for about 15 to 20 seconds, and then finally it kicked in. But it scared the living life out of me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that type of thing was an automatic function, just like your heart beating and other automatic things that come from the brain stem. I wondered what if anything you had an opinion on.
Well, I'd have to ask you felt short of breath?
I had absolutely no lung function at all, doctor. I mean, I could not take a breath in for about 15 to 20 seconds. And
I'm not sure I'm not sure what might cause that. So one thing we want to know is what your background is with regard to your lungs. Do you have any lung disease or any other medical problems?
I had some bronchitis about a month ago. I did follow up with my primary care physician, and he said, well, he said, my guess is that the signals in the brain stem that provide the automated function were messed up for that one brief period of time.
Well, that, to my way of thinking, doesn't generally happen, okay? So, in fact, what you're describing is extremely unusual. So I would think that one would need to do a little bit more exploration of exactly what it is that occurred. And by that I mean, you know, looking at your chest x-ray, doing maybe pulmonary function tests on you. I wouldn't just assume that it is a neurological problem. And I've not heard of someone who would have a neurological problem related to for 15 or 20 seconds that they would stop breathing, be conscious, stop breathing, and then, you know, kind of consciously force themselves to breathe. And that was then they got back and they were normal thereafter, didn't have the problem subsequently, were able to go to sleep at night, woke up and were still alive and, you know, were breathing. I mean, it's kind of hard. I'd be hard pressed to explain exactly what happened to you. You can suppose and presuppose a lot of things about what might go on in the brain. On the other hand, what specifically would be the medical problem that caused that? It would have to be, you know, elucidated. You might need to see a neurologist, but I would first start with, you know, looking at lung function. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a very strange presentation of problem, and it would need to be, you know, investigated further, in my opinion, before you could really render a reasonable idea of what could have happened.
Okay, listen, James, I'm so sorry, but we really got to move along. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, doctor.
Right. Okay, well, let's go to Mac in Albany. Okay, Mac, you're on.
Thanks, Alan, for everything. Congratulations. Dr. Lemansky.
Thank you.
I'm 67. I have swelling in my feet that developed fairly suddenly after some years of mild swelling in my ankles. Mm-hmm. It's asymmetrical. The left foot is worse.
Mm.
I have trouble getting my left shoe on, although it still fits. And I did go to the ER to have it looked at. The doctor, you know, young doctor, didn't do any tests, thought because it was bilateral, though asymmetrical, it was probably not a blood clot. How concerned should I be? What else could be causing it?
Well, I think you should
be. I'm somewhat overweight.
Yeah, I think you should be concerned. How overweight are you?
I weigh about 180 with the edema, which goes up into my legs. It was about in the low 180s at 5'5.5" with a light frame.
Yeah. You should be talking to your primary about this. First of all, when you have some base...
I did see the physician's assistant in my primary's.
Okay. When you have some baseline swelling in your feet, and a lot of people have that on a dependent
ankle swelling.
Right, dependent edema is what we call it. You know, as a baseline, a lot of people have that. Sometimes it's on a function of how much sodium they consume, how much salt they're eating. If then one leg goes disproportionately swollen, then that needs to be investigated, and you raise the issue of a blood clot, and that would be one thing that would pop into my head. That really can only be excluded with an ultrasound of the vessels, the veins in your leg. So that should have been done, in my opinion. You know, then of course, someone to address the reasons why you have swelling in the first place. Swelling could be a function of a kidney problem, could be a function of a heart problem. So one would need to investigate further what exactly was going on that was causing the edema in the first place. If all the workup was negative and it turned out that we really weren't able to find anything and you don't have any varicose veins in your legs, or maybe even if you did, that'd be a potential explanation. You know, vascular hose can do a lot to reverse the effects of swelling in the extremities. But
yeah,
first,
my father had phlebitis and had vascular hose.
You had phlebitis in the past?
My father.
Oh, okay. But you would have to have a workup done. You can't just jump to a conclusion that, oh, well, you just got some swelling.
Okay, listen, guys, we have to take a break. Paul, we've had a couple of people wanting to know your phone number at work. What is? Do you know the new phone number?
Yeah, it's six. Yeah, here, it's my first day at the office.
At the new place, right.
At the new place. So yeah. It's... 640-3260.
Do it again. 640.
640-3260.
60. Okay. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Live Well, Albany, New York, providing intensive outpatient psychological services for treatment of eating disorders in and around the Capital Region, albanyhpa.com. H. Housed and Son True Value, Woodstock, New York, since 1932, a local store featuring hardware, Benjamin Moore paint, and tool and equipment rentals. True Value, behind every project is a true value, hhoused.com. FarmyMarket.com, an online farmer's market delivering local food from family-owned farms to homes in the Capital Region. FarmyMarket.com for orders. And from the Ashokan Center, a classroom in the wild where nature inspires conferences, festivals, family celebrations, and outdoor education for schools. AshokanCenter.org.
And we are back with the wonderful Dr. Paul Lemansky, and Paul's here just having opened up a whole new thing that had not he had not done before, the Center for Preventive Medicine. Paul, what's the name of the new place?
Center for Preventive Medicine at Capital Care Medical Group.
At Capital Care Medical Group. Okay, let's go to Nan. All right, I think it's Nan. Is that Nan?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Nan. Go ahead.
I was wondering if the doctor could speak a little bit about protein in the diet and how important it becomes for us as we age, what amount daily might be correct, and if any type of protein is better than another, such as plant versus meat versus protein bars.
No, I wouldn't say protein bars are the way to go. You know, protein has always been important in the human diet. I wouldn't say that people need necessarily more as they get older. Usually, you know, Americans are getting about 60 grams of protein, 60 to 80 grams of protein a day, and I think that's perfectly sufficient. What you want to make sure is that the protein, that if you choose to get your protein from a non-animal source,
like rice and beans, you mean?
Yeah, is that you know a little bit about protein complementarity. So even animal protein, and I'm talking plant-based proteins, all proteins are going to be broken down into their constituent amino acids before absorption. So what you basically, you know, when you eat an animal protein, why is that most useful to the body and it's most easily used? It's simply because it already has the proper ratios of those constituent amino acids so that you can make your own, you know, muscle from an animal's muscle. Nevertheless, you can eat a plant-based diet where you get a sufficient amount of protein. You need not take it from an animal source. Now, those individuals who are going to be exclusively vegan, exclusively vegetable-based, exclusively plant-based, may need to look out at protein complementarity. Understanding when we talk about protein complementarity, we're just trying to get the amino acid ratios to be appropriate to make human protein, to make human flesh, to make human muscle. So that you can use it for repair, so that you can use it for building tissue. It's not difficult to do. As Alan was saying, rice and beans, for example, would be complementing the amino acids in rice with the amino acids in beans so as to mill the protein that a human could use. If you're eating a predominantly plant-based diet, that means you're eating a little bit of fish, you're eating a little bit of chicken. All that helps to make the proteins that you do eat useful to the body right away.
Nan, so sorry, we got to let you go. Thanks again for calling. Big lineup behind you. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Our wonderful volunteer here is asking, Joe Mackowitz is asking me to read your number, so I will do it this time. 518-640-3260. So get
That's
it right,
correct.
Folks. 518-640-3260. Okay, we'll go to Ron in South Glens Falls. Okay, Ron, you're on.
Hello. I'm 68 years old, and about a year and a half ago, I had high cholesterol, so I went to a plant-based diet.
Mm-hmm.
And lately, I've had a problem with some tendonitis issues.
Mm-hmm.
Could I add some meat to my diet in an to try to help that situation out? Is there any connection there?
Well, it depends on what you mean. If you're saying a plant-based diet, you're a vegan. Is that what you're saying?
You only eat
vegetables and fruits. You're not eating any animal products.
Well, I eat a little bit. Every once in a while, we go out to eat, and I'll have chicken, probably chicken.
Okay.
But
what I
95% of the time, I just
So if you're kind of doing this on the fly a bit, and you don't really have a good understanding of how to complement protein, it could be a problem with breakdown of tissue. So the best thing to do would be to visit a registered dietitian, and he or she would be able to go over with you how to do the complementary amino acids so that you'd be able to, have good protein, good quality protein for your body.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. For the first time in this program, you have a chance to get in. 1-800-348-2551. Ken in Statsburg. Okay, Ken, you're on.
Hi, this is Ken. Back in January 5th, I was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and on March 7th, they removed my bladder and made a new bladder called the needle bladder out of 2 feet of my small intestine near the large intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And my digestion since then hasn't quite recovered to the way it was before, and I totally don't expect it to. But the main problem seems to be my BM is really erratic. Sometimes I'll go for a day or two, and it's rather firm and not too bad. And I go one or two times a day, and then the next day I'll have to go four times, and it starts out okay, but it winds up runny and even turn into water sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've settled on doing that seems to help is eat things that I'm not supposed to eat. I used to eat real healthy chicken and all that sort of stuff and fish and vegetables, but the vegetables have to be cooked really good, and red meat tends to bind me up much as we're not supposed to eat that, but at least it keeps the food in me,
mm-hmm.
and white rice and things like that when I should be eating brown rice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Well, we're really operating with not sufficient data to make recommendations as to what you should or shouldn't eat. But again, I would refer you, first of all, have you come with this problem to your primary care doctor, to your gastroenterologist?
My primary care, and he's referred me to my gastroenterologist.
And what has the gastroenterologist told you?
I'll be seeing him next Monday. I heard your program on today, and I just made the
Understood.
Appointment today, so I figured I'd
sure.
give a call.
Sure. What exactly the surgery was that you had done, what portion of your intestine was resected, how much was taken out, there are a number of different issues that could impact your symptoms. But generally speaking, they're going to preserve the first couple of feet of the small intestine. Not going to use that because that's where your absorptive surface is for absorbing nutrients, vitamins. So I'm not really quite sure exactly what was done But do you know which portion of the bowel was resected?
The last 2 feet of the small intestine.
Last 2 feet. Okay.
Yeah, where it joins the large intestine.
Right.
There.
Okay. So, yeah, the thing that's absorbed primarily in the last 2 feet of the small intestine is B12. So you would have to have B12, you know, measured to make sure that you were able to absorb it. If you weren't able to absorb it, then they'd have to give you intramuscular injections of B12. Other than that, though, one would have to do, a full and complete workup to try and explain why you were having the digestive problems before we could conclude that something nutritionally would be beneficial and indeed curative.
Okay.
So more information is needed.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Josephine in Rhinebeck. Okay, yeah, Josephine in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Yes, if it's true that the skin absorbs whatever is put on it and sends it into the bloodstream, how does one assess what is safe to put on the skin?
I'm not quite sure.
So, in other words, if you were to put on sunscreen, would that be safe? I think is your question, right, Josephine?
Yes, but different sunscreens contain different ingredients.
Sure, sure. That's a good question. I guess, you know, the issue would be that you shouldn't put any chemicals on your skin without having assessed the risk-benefit of that particular chemical. Obviously, individuals who go out and in the sun a lot and don't want to wear protective clothing are going to be, depending upon their skin type, forced to use something to protect their skin. If you don't go out in the sun, then I wouldn't be putting that on just, you know, for short exposures, and I would rely more on clothing to protect your skin rather than on chemicals. There's no data that the chemicals actually decrease the risk of skin cancer either yet. So we know it decreases. We make recommendations to do so on the hope that it will, but we don't know for an absolute certainty, for example, that it will decrease melanoma deaths.
Huh. Yeah, well, that's okay with the sunscreen, but what about moisturizers and other stuff that's put on the skin?
Well, you know, you're asking, unfortunately, a question which is an excellent question, and we don't really know a lot about. There are a number of things in moisturizers that potentially could cause issues, but, you know, the amounts that are absorbed are going to be probably small. It's like saying, should I eat organic? And I'd say, yes, eat organic, but understanding that even eating organic, you're going to get pesticide residues in your body. So it's in terms of how much, you know, the exposure is going to be, how frequently it's applied, this kind of thing. I would try to not dry the skin out in the first place and only use moisturizers if you absolutely required it for dry skin. Doing so by choosing those which had more natural ingredients rather than, synthesized chemicals, certainly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Josephine.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye. We'll go to Anne in Valencia. Anne, you're on.
Hi, doctors. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a 16, going on 17-year-old granddaughter who is a vegan, and she just recently gave up dairy. She's convinced herself she is lactose intolerant, which I don't think she really is. Loves animals. That's why she won't eat meat. She also has a tree nut allergy. Mm-hmm. And a weight problem, and I'm just concerned, and so is my daughter, that she's, has a real aversion to food. She's convinced herself that all these things are bad for her, and
excuse me,
cutting them out of diet.
If I could just ask, the weight problem being one where she is underweight?
No, overweight.
She's overweight. Okay, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Which is all of a sudden, too. I mean, I guess around the time when her menstrual cycle became regular, she gained a lot of weight. Not a lot of weight. I mean, she probably weighs about 140, but she's my height. She's 5'3". So she's a little chunky. I wouldn't say she thinks she's grossly overweight, but she is not. And, you know, she's looking at going away to college, and my daughter is afraid to send her away for fear that, you know, she will become anorexic. So So I really don't know what my question is. I guess who would you recommend that she see? She's already seeing a psychologist.
I think some practical information. A registered dietitian is the person to, you know, give her information. Certainly, you know, lots of teenagers, you can give them recommendations. As a parent, they're not going to listen to you. However, if you have someone that's trustworthy, like a dietitian who's basing their recommendations on science, it'll gain your confidence. And because it's not you, it may gain a teenager's confidence that they're getting the straight information and not getting something, you know, that is coming through a parent that has to be held suspect in some way.
And thank you for the call. A lot of people behind you. We appreciate your calling in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go to Lauren in Albany. Lauren, go.
Hi. I'm calling you for about vegan diets. I was wondering if you would be comfortable and if maybe you should be saying that there's a difference between healthy vegan, natural vegan foods versus all the processed fake meat, fake everything that's out there that has a label that says vegan, but is actually has more chemicals or just as many chemicals as other processed foods?
Well, I mean, I can only speak personally on this. I don't really like products, whether they say they're vegan or not. I think we should stick as close to the natural vegetables as possible, not processed, the minimally processed vegetables. So, yeah, I guess I agree with you in that regard.
Because I think in your position, because you do have voice of authority and expertise.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we're also just exercising common sense. I don't know that I have any outcome data to support what I'm suggesting. But to me, it makes good common sense that a product that's being put together by a company where they're trying to maximize profit is not necessarily going to include in it all the things that you would normally want to do. I find very few products that are out there really meet my criteria for health. And, we already have vegetables and fruits that the good Lord gave us, and we just need to utilize them ourselves properly. And that includes, when washing them and preparing them in a healthful fashion. I think a lot has to be left to the individual here. I don't think it could be one can substitute simply on the basis of convenience products and expect that you're going to get exactly the same health benefit from them.
Okay.
In general. I'm speaking in general.
Paul and Lauren, I'm so sorry. Thank you very much for your time. We have three calls on the line. I want to go very quickly. Maybe we can answer some of them without actually talking to people. Otherwise, we don't get a chance. Okay. Monty from Saratoga wants to know about swollen lymph nodes and low function. FNC, I think that's function. I don't know.
All right. Well, that's, depends on who made the diagnosis of swollen lymph nodes. If it is actually something that a physician noted, it's going to require a workup and evaluation.
Yeah, sure.
Depending upon the age of the patient, I mean, it could be something like, a lymphoma,
right.
Or it could be a viral illness in a younger person. So it really depends.
Okay. Matt from Rosendale wants to know, how long do cardiac bypass last?
Well, that's an excellent question. If it depends on the type of vessel used in the bypass procedure. So as would make sense, if you're using a vein graft, a vein was not meant to take the place of an artery, and as a consequence, doesn't really hold up as well. And usually there's about a 30 or 40% failure rate after 5 or 6 years. In individuals who have their cholesterol down and practice good dietary habits and control their blood pressure, that may last quite a bit longer. Internal artery mammary grafts, which are actual arterial grafts, are those which last the longest and don't plug up over time.
Okay, thank you very much. Karen, we left you on the line, and I'm so sorry. We are out of time. Joining us today was Dr. Paul Lemansky of Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine in Albany. We've been besieged by people who want his telephone number at the office, 518-640 518-640-3260. Again, 518-640-3260. Paul Lemansky, thank you so much. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update. Thank you, Paul Lemansky.